Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo. And we have a topic today that I think is an especially powerful one. Have any of you ever watched the program on television, Cold Case? Well, it's one of my favorites. The reason it is and I don't often have a chance to watch it, is because things that were abandoned because of a lack of evidence or being able to donate the time and the effort to do the research necessary on a particular issue so often evolves in fresh minds, fresh areas of technology, so much comes in, and the cold case is picked up and taken on and sometimes resolved. Well, that's what we're going to be talking about today. My guest, Larry Edwards, is a man that has had quite a traumatic experience that happened with his family. In fact, it involves crime on the high seas, murder. His book is titled, Dare I Call It Murder, and it's a memoir of type, but it's also a reaching out to see if there is any way that this can possibly be resolved. I want to invite to the show Larry Edwards. Larry, it's really a pleasure having you on the air.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure to be on the show with you, Donna.
Now, Larry, you live in San Diego.
Yes.
You have been an editor of publications, and you are a man that has, you have such a poignant story. When I started reading this, I thought, wow, I don't know how I would have dealt with something like this. And you, this has been a big challenge for you and your family for, oh my goodness, a number of years. Give us some background on the story. Tell us what happened to your family.
Well, my family was going to, had planned a multi-year sailing cruise. My father, who built our home in Kirkland, Washington, sold the home, built a sailboat, and was going to take us all on this long cruise to bring our family together. That was his big plan. And unfortunately, things did not go the way he had hoped. And my parents ended up being killed aboard their boat in French Polynesia. This was in 1978. And I had left the boat in San Diego because I sensed problems down the road, and I certainly didn't expect my parents to die, but I figured there would be problems on the boat, and there were, and they ended up dead, and left alive on the boat were my brother, my younger brother, who was 27 at the time, and the youngest of my three sisters, Carrie, who was 20 years old at the time, and then the daughter of a family friend. Her name was Lori Oscom, and she was 21. So, and when there were some inconsistencies over how my parents died in terms of what my brother was saying about how they died versus other known facts at the time, based on radio calls and offers of assistance from other boaters in the area. And so the FBI investigated the case, and as you said, they labeled it crime on the high seas, murder, and they were looking at my brother as the prime suspect. However, the case was never prosecuted, even though the FBI asked the U.S. attorneys in Seattle to prosecute to prosecute the case. The U.S. attorney declined to prosecute for a number of reasons. Primarily because my parents' bodies had been dumped over the side of the boat, and the boat had been cleaned not long after the incident, so there was very little forensic evidence available. And my sister and the other woman on the boat basically just repeated whatever my brother said in terms of what happened aboard the boat. So rather than prosecute and risk incurring jeopardy in the case, that is, losing the case, the prosecutors just said we won't prosecute and hope that more information comes out later and maybe we can reopen it if that happens. So the only real people who could come forward with more information would be my sister and the other woman on the boat.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and
before we go in,
and we're still
Larry,
waiting.
Yeah, before we go into that, what I would like my listeners to know is that, number one, this was a very violent situation. And number two, the reason that you wrote this book, and this is 35 years plus since the incident, you say it's very important that people understand the trauma that occurs when there is a violent situation like what happened with your family and the impact on survivors of a horrific incident like this. And this is stated right in the front of your book. You say, professionally trained therapists who understand the distinction between natural death and violent criminal death. Survivors of violent loss and criminal death often suffer from intense anger, severe depression, PTSD, and there needs to be an understanding of how to deal with this because people need to be able to get on with their lives. And you actually, in 1998, established a particular organization so that people are going to have someone to communicate with, and that is called the Survivors of Violent Loss Program. And you say there are a few other organizations, and it's very, very important that people know that in your book, Dare I Call It Murder, you are not coming from a positioning of just verbally expounding just for the sake of expounding. You have taken correspondence, police records, FBI records, even French official records, everything that you could. You've accumulated this during these 35 years, and you present the facts because you do want this resolved. You want it put into its proper positioning. But in your book, you also bring out the very human factor of fear that so often prevents the truth from being revealed. And I think that your book is extremely powerful. How long did it take you to put this together?
Well, Donna, thank you very much for the compliments and kind words about the book. I kept notes during the entire time I was on the boat and during the investigation. I kept a journal with an eye toward doing something about this down the road if necessary. So, from one sense you might say I spent 35 years working on this, but I got really serious on it about 12 years ago around the 25th anniversary of the deaths, and or as that anniversary approached, and I went back to the FBI and said, look, I want to know what happened. I want to know what you know that you haven't told me. And the agent told me a few things about the relationships aboard the boat, including a relationship between my sister and brother. And he helped me get a hold of a copy of the FBI report so that I had basically the same information they did, and that's when I got serious about it. And I tried to enlist my sister in the project, but she refused to cooperate with me. And so I went forward on my own, and the book languished a little bit because it was hard to write.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. then in 2009, true crime writer Ann Rule published a book, and that book contained an account of my parents' deaths. And unfortunately, she hadn't contacted anyone in the family about this, so we didn't know about it until the book was actually on the shelves in stores. And it contained lots of errors about the case that were published in newspapers 30 years earlier. So that gave me the impetus to finish this book, in part to set the record straight, but also, as you said, to discuss violent loss and violent dying and the impact that has on the surviving family members and close friends.
Mm-hmm. I think also your book brings out one of the greatest challenges that any investigating group has. You deal with human nature, and if there is a component of shame, anger, which was on the case of your sister, where we can't say anything, when there's manipulation, psychological manipulation, when you have a pathological liar, when you are trying to create the truth and the facts out of lies, when you're trying to extract that, my goodness, it's like doing a root canal, because you're dealing with human personality and character. And when you have fear at a base of that investigation, it paralyzes people many times. And often they become afraid of what other people will think. You were not stuck with that quandary because you were not on that boat. If you had been on that boat, you probably would not have survived. Maybe it wouldn't have happened. Who knows? And I'm sure those questions came into your mind. Gee, if I'd been there, maybe this wouldn't have happened. But I would say that's probably not the case, because it appeared to me when I was reading the story that this had been thought out very, very carefully. Very, very carefully. Now, with you, when I was going through the story, you say that there are an estimated 15,240 murders in the United States, and this was 2009, that had the potential for affecting 152,400 survivors. That's quite a powerful batching of numbers, but I think it even goes further. I think many times when people learn of these cases, it ripples out that there is a level of fear that goes out among many individuals. Heavens, we see it stuff publicized on television all the time. It's something that media is very aware of, and it can create a very negative ripple instead of coming from a positioning of let's find out the truth, let's dig down into the guts of something. It's, oh my goodness, I don't want this happening to me. So people stand back, they back away. Betrayal is one of the strong words that you use, and you felt very strongly this way, especially by your family members that had survived this horrific experience. Now, you got the files from the FBI in December of 2003. And how you got the records on the investigation, and please correct me if I'm in error on this, you had submitted a request to the Department of Justice under the Freedom of Information Act in October 2002. So it took over a year for you to get this material. And you, actually, it's 14 months, wasn't it?
Yes.
Then you had, let's face it, the FBI has a tremendously large amount of material and information. So they have to locate all this stuff. And this is a 35-year-old cold case. And it was labeled as crime on the high seas. And then you had interdepartmental correspondence that had been sent to the U.S. Attorney's Office. Boy, I'm sure that package must have weighed a good 10 pounds by the time you got it.
It's about the size of a large city phone book, yes.
My goodness. Now, you found that you were the only person outside of law enforcement to hear the statements by your brother to investigators. You were the only person, and this is 35 years later. I mean, this is not 35 years later, but this is quite incredible right there.
Yes. Yeah, the FBI interviewed my brother, I think, three times while we were in Tahiti. And they kicked me out of the first interview. But the second one, we went aboard the boat where the deaths occurred. And they had my brother walk through the entire scenario and explain to them again what happened. And they wanted me to listen. They had certainly ulterior motives. They weren't just being nice to me. They wanted me to help them pressure my brother to tell, be a little more forthcoming. And well, I'm telling the truth, because they weren't buying into what he was saying, because they had other evidence from talking to other boaters, and they also had transcripts of the radio calls that my brother made when the deaths occurred, and they were not consistent. So they wanted me to help them get more information on my brother, but it didn't work that way. My brother basically refused to talk to me about it, and when I confronted him, his response was, "You don't want to know." And of course, I do want to know.
Well, he was telling you the truth in that statement. You don't want to know, because
didn't want me to know.
That's right. He didn't want you to know, because if the truth were really stated, it would be horrific. Now, my audience, I'm sure, has no awareness of this case. Would you say, if you don't mind, what happened, where the boat was, what was found, and the story that was told?
So my parents died aboard their sailboat in French Polynesia near Tahiti. And my brother reported my father's death and an injury to my sister on Friday morning, February 24th, 1978. And at the time, he said that the boom on the mainsail of the boat had gotten loose and struck them in the head. That's the story we were getting initially. And then we didn't hear from him until the next day, when he reported that our mother had now died, but he didn't give an explanation. I flew to Tahiti to meet the boat and to bring my parents' bodies home and to get my sister home safely and to get the boat home. And I learned there that, A, there were no bodies, because my brother had thrown them over the side of the boat, and B, that what we'd been told initially was not the case, that that my sister and my dad were injured in separate incidents, allegedly. My sister had an accident and fell an hour or two later, coincidentally, apparently. My father had lost his balance and fell on the boat and struck his head so hard that he died. And later, my mother shot herself with my brother's semi-automatic pistol. This is the story that I was told by my sister and later by my brother. But even the timing was not accurate, because later we learned that all this happened in a very short period of time, maybe within an hour, maybe 2 hours, 3 hours at most, probably all of this occurred with my sister getting injured. And she later testified that she, in fact, did not have an accident, but that she had been assaulted and raped by our brother.
Mm-hmm.
And that my father died shortly thereafter, and then our mother died again shortly after that. So that's what we know from my sister's testimony. However, my sister basically refused to say this in court. She
mm-hmm.
wanted to maintain that there were accidents and the boom hit them and so on. And, you know, you were talking about the fear factor. Well, she told me that, you know, she was afraid that if she testified truthfully that and my brother was convicted, he'd get out of prison in a few years and come back and kill her.
Mm-hmm.
That's her stated fear. But you also brought up other, you know, other emotional factors, shame being one of them. And, you know, I can't get inside my sister's head, but I have a suspicion that maybe that plays as much, if not a greater role, in her rationale
mm-hmm.
than the fear.
I would say so. I would say that, and especially when you think of the time, here we are, 2013, this was done 35 years ago. You think of the modality of that time frame, and she has to live with that every single day. And at that time, more so than today, any woman that would have admitted to this type of thing would have just felt horrific shame. Not that it doesn't exist today, because it does. And it's a very personal thing. But when you know and you're terrified, that's where someone who is exceptionally violent, you hear the stories in domestic abuse all the time. I know. I've dealt in counseling with clients through the years. And you'll say, why in the world do you put up with this? I'm afraid they're going to kill me, or I'm going to do this. When someone has a reign of terror over or establishes a reign of terror, and they know the psychological patterning of that person, then they use that. They manipulate it. Now, is your brother Gary still alive?
Yes. Yes, he's alive, and I believe he's living somewhere in Texas.
With what you've gone through with this case, with what you've done with this book, the story that you've told is extremely telling. Do you feel that this is ever going to be resolved?
Well, I'm not holding my breath, but you know, I hold out hope that it will be, that my sister and or the other woman on the boat will come forward and be more forthcoming and more truthful about what actually happened on the boat. I think they owe it to my parents to do that, to our parents.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm hoping that maybe through this book finally being published and the story, the untold story being told, and you know, through the help of people like yourself who are willing to discuss this story, that maybe either she will have enough confidence to come forward, or you know, there just may be enough pressure on her to do that. So, you know, I hold out hope, but you know, after so many years, it's you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, I'd put that at about a 1 or a 2 of it
mm-hmm.
actually happening. But you know, we read periodically about 30- and 40-year-old cases being resolved. So
mm-hmm.
Usually, it is
many times they're resolved because the material has been left behind, or deathbed confession. Something
yeah.
where someone is able to bring forth information that allows the truth to be told. But there is, you know, you have to look at it, I think, also from a number of factors. It's so easy many times to blame a law enforcement agency, but if you don't have enough forensic evidence, even in today's world, and with all the technology we've got, I think that they are able to do an even better job. When you think this occurred over in French Polynesia 35 years ago, everything was so primitive compared to what we're able to work with today. But if you have people that hide the truth, that are not willing to come forward, and this is what you expressed in the beginning of our conversation, how the FBI wanted you to speak up, wanted you to express certain things, but you didn't have the details. You didn't. They could only get so much from you because you were not on that boat. You were not anywhere close to it. You saw it sail off with your family, and that was it. And they had already surmised the truth, but to be able to go through the legal procedure without a shadow of a doubt, without enough information, in many ways their hands are tied, and that can be very frustrating. But I'll tell you what, Larry, I think you have done an incredible job with this. I think the organization that you have founded, perhaps to someone listening that has lost a member of family or a friend to something that's horrifically violent, like what happened to your family, dare I call it murder, a memoir of violent loss. Larry Edwards, I think you've done a very courageous thing here by publishing your story. And let's know that justice in one way or another will be served, and let's hope that those members of your family and or the friends that do know the truth may not be so frightened and will be able to speak up and say what they know so that maybe this can finally be a cold case that is resolved. Larry Edwards, your website is dareicallitmurder.com, dareicallitmurder.com. And people can go there and find out more about your family's story. Thank you for being my guest today, Larry.
Donna, thank you very much. I really do appreciate this opportunity to talk about the book and my story.
It's my pleasure. Donna Sebo here. Don't forget to check it out, dareicallitmurder.com. It gives you not just an insight into a very personal family situation about a tragedy that's horrific on the high seas, but more than that, it also makes you aware of the process of the legal system. And I think that this is something that we need to be alert to. There's a lot that goes on that we just don't have a clue about, and I'm not being facetious when I say that. I mean that with utmost sincerity. Many times there are dedicated law enforcement officers that want to do the best they possibly can, and they can only work with what they have at the moment in front of them. But maybe someone somewhere will be able to complete this story so that this family can lay to rest the agony of not having resolution. Dare I call it murder? A fascinating read. Real true story. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. Don't go away.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Amino Muscle Snack Time, the chewable nutrition that feeds your muscles. Amino acids are the building blocks of protein. When you exercise, muscle tissue naturally breaks down. This low-cal, chewable snack helps to reverse that process and won't pack on the pounds. You can chew a few tasty vanilla tablets or any one of their other flavors before or after physical exercise, right before bedtime, or first thing in the morning to jumpstart your metabolism into gear for the day. Convenient to carry in a purse, backpack, or briefcase, they are a tasty snack for the person on the go. Firm, fit muscles, trim, healthy body. Sound good to you? Check out Amino Muscle Snack Time Chewable Nutrition by going to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Tone up, trim up, and nourish your body to the fitness level you desire. Amino Muscle Snack Time Nutritional Tablets. Check out the information and order today. Go to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Order now.
Hello and welcome back. This is Donna Sebo, and telephone lines are now open. That's right, so you're more than welcome to give me a call. If you would like to chat with me, I would be delighted to give you a complimentary reading on the air. All you need to do is give me your first name or initial. After that, I will tell you what I perceive, and then you're welcome to ask me a question about anything that you like. I thought I would share with you someone that decided they were going to resolve a challenge that they had. And what was that challenge? Well, it was clutter. Now, in 2003, a woman by the name of Vivian Palmer, her house burned to the ground. That is awful. I wouldn't wish that on anybody. I mean, I think of the poor people in Colorado right now that have lost their homes in this horrific flood. When disaster hits and everything is taken away from you, it's just devastating. I mean, there's no other way to say it. Now, Vivian had a very different effect hit her. After she went through the numbness, the shock of having everything gone, there was nothing, absolutely nothing left from this fire. She said, I became aware that I was free. That's sort of a strange statement, isn't it? I'm free. She said, I would remember something in particular and realize it's gone. There's nothing I can do about it. She said, I really felt a sense of freedom. My clutter was gone, everything was gone, and so I was starting all over. Now, 10 years after the fact, she said she looked at all of the stuff she had accumulated. All of us have stuff. But she found that she had acquired a lot more than she really wanted. So she designed a project. And I thought this was quite interesting. She called it Project 3650. And this was her commitment with this project. She was going to let go of at least 10 things every day for a year. And that meant a total of 3,650 donated or sold items. Now, that's a lot of clutter. I mean, that's a whole bunch of stuff to get rid of. Now, a friend said to her, wait a minute. This is crazy. What are you doing this for? You're going to just absolutely fail at this. Why are you even considering it? However, she said she decided she was going to follow through with it. So she put her plan into place, and she started this past February. Now, in the process of doing this, she found that she had plastic forks and spoons and all kinds of little tidbits in her drawers, like in her kitchen. So she bundled those together, and she counted them all, and every little plastic fork helped. And she gave them away. And then, she said, in February, she found that there was a lot of stuff that her kids had had. She said, they don't use it. It's just accumulating. On February the 7th, specifically, it was a Davy Crockett un-coonskin cap, she said. She had bags of plastic bags. She had cloth napkins that didn't match. She found bandanas. She had two tablecloths. She had two nightmare-inducing cymbal-clapping toy monkeys. And she also found she had a toy dog made of real animal fur. She said, okay, my husband doesn't want me to get rid of that one. She said, I can't stand it. But anyway, she does this. Now, what she did to keep herself on track, as she's going through all of this, she posts the images of things that she's getting rid of. On her process of elimination blog, she gives a lot of this stuff away for free. She said it feels good. She just likes it. So instead of going to one of the charitable organizations and donating there, where nobody would even know what she's getting rid of, she decided to post it because it's giving her the momentum to stay committed to this goal, she said, set for herself, Project 3650. She said, it's exciting. She said, I just love it. And she said, sometimes she sells the items, and she wants to raise enough money so her family can travel, her whole family can go to Southeast Asia. She wants to have this trip. And she said, you know what? It's absolutely amazing. She has some clothing, and I've got a picture of one of her outfits in front of me that really is quite beautiful. It's a vintage dress. She said, I'll never wear it. She's got keys, she said, that I have that I just don't want to be bothered with. She has some heirlooms, and they belong to her grandmother, and so she's going to be selling those. And she said, I have got a train case full of wires, connectors, and chargers that I no longer own. So she is having a blast cleaning up the clutter in her life. And I think, what a fun way to do it, and what a way to stay committed. So she is holding true to the best of her capacity, and I'm sure that her kids and her husband have certain items they don't want her to get rid of. But by golly, here is a woman that decided to do something, went public with it, and is really having a fun time. And there are so many individuals that have gone on to having a business by going on eBay, doing auctioning on Craigslist, all kinds of stuff that they do. So who knows? Maybe that is a good way to take care of clutter. Me, I just like to put stuff in boxes and take them to the Goodwill or Salvation Army or what have you. And there's so many wonderful charities. So many people are having difficult times because they're out of work. Old furniture, things that you really don't want anymore, just releasing it, letting it go. If it's been sitting around for a long time, it just, I can relate to how she feels. It really is nice to know that what you've got perhaps is going to go and benefit somebody else's life. Donna Sebo here, 888-627-6008. Quickly, I want to make a mention of the fact that I'm going to be appearing on September the 28th at the Emerald Spiral Expo. I'm going to be speaking there at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I also will be having a booth, and this is for an expo that's been going on, oh my goodness, for well over 30 years, close to 40, I believe. And it originally started with the concept of just having people so that they would have the opportunity to meet with individuals that have different intuitive talents, and it's grown and developed to such a level today that it is just absolutely wonderful. So you encounter all kinds of people, people like me and different vendors that collect stones from around the world, just all kinds of talented individuals right here in the Pacific Northwest. So if you're in Western Washington, put it down on your calendar. The hours are from 9 until 5. I'll be in booth number 25, and I'll have a plethora of books as well as some wonderful samples to give away from Danny Torres and his snack time products that have been a part of this programming, and oh, are they good. So you'll be able to take them home and share them with your family and friends as well. So mark it on your calendar, September the 28th. Wherever you are in the world, I don't care what country you live in, there's always going to be something about taxation. Yes, history is replete with how people have fought it, complained about it. I always chuckle when I think of old ancient records, even with the Mesopotamians, where they complained about taxes. However it was done, it's something that I don't know of any civilization, the people within it, ever enjoying. But lots of times people have done different things, and I believe it was in Holland that there was a taxation that was put upon people by government officials, the height of the building and the width of the building. Well, they were going to tax you on the width of the building, so people went higher. They built little narrow houses. And I came across this article that just made me chuckle, because this didn't have anything to do with taxes, but there were other motivations for it. There are homes that were really built to irritate somebody else. And then Alexandria, Virginia, there was a person that had an alley next to his house, and he was just not wanting people to use that alley. Now, the property belonged to him. So what he did, he built a 7-foot house between his and the other house. So I have the picture in front of me. There's no space there. There's no alley. They didn't want an alley. So that's what this guy did. He utilized that space by building this 7-foot house, a 7-foot wide house. It's taller than 7 feet. Excuse me. I said the wrong thing. It's 7 foot wide. It fills that alley. It's two floors, and it's just amazing. Also, there was a plot of land, and this was in a family. Two brothers had inherited this plot of land, and one brother built a huge house on it while the other brother was away in the military. And this was done in 1874. The location is Boston. Now, the brother that had a little tiny piece of property, he hadn't had any choice over this. That's all he got left. He constructed a small wooden house that was right next on this property, right next to his brother's, which blocked the sunlight and destroyed the brother's view. And I've got a picture of it in front of me, and it is literally 3 stories high. And boy, it just is amazing. People's emotions can really create some interesting results. And then you may have seen this because it happened in China, and this was really quite a big story. There's an elderly couple, a gentleman by the name of Lau and his wife. When they were told by the government that the city wanted to buy their home in China, they wanted to demolish the house, and they really didn't want the government to take it away. Well, all the neighboring homes were knocked down, but they did not agree to the government buying their house. They stayed put, and a road was constructed around the house. You can find that on the internet. It was done in Wenling, China. And here is this huge freeway that has been built, and here is this house, cars in their driveway, so to speak, right there. People have to go around this house. It's just an amazing thing to see. Human ingenuity, determination, and saying, you can't do this to me. I have an option, and this is what I'm going to exercise. Those are 3 instances with a home, or homes, I should say, that make a difference. This is Donna Sebo. Give me a call at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Give me a buzz, and we can chat. By the way, we are going to have Dr. Bernie Siegel on tomorrow. This is a wonderful man. I'm sure you've heard of Bernie. He is a man that is a physician with a heart. But more than that, he's got a wisdom that he shares with you and me, and it will be able to make your life a better experience because of that sharing. The Art of Healing. We'll be talking with Bernie tomorrow. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Good health is something all of us want to have. Being aware of what we eat, its nutritional value, and how to balance our physical needs with our busy schedules is always a challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time goes a long way towards helping us meet this challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time is a nutritional food product that is portable, tasty, and in chewable tablet form, vanilla and honey flavors, a bonus for maintaining a healthy amino acid balance for healthy muscles. Amino Muscle Snack Time can be used anytime, anywhere, first thing in the morning to kickstart your metabolism. Take 20 minutes before or after a workout to help recover and build muscle. Take mid-morning or mid-afternoon to help curb cravings for unhealthy snacks. Weight loss, appetite control. Only top-of-the-line and no genetically modified ingredients are used, no caffeine added. These chewable tablets can be ordered through Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Take charge and jumpstart your food program by adding Amino Muscle Snack Time by visiting Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com for more information. Order now.
Hi, this is Donna. I wanted to let you know about a story that I just, of course, I have a soft spot for dogs anyway, but I really enjoyed this one. And they called it Canine Kismet. Now, this takes place after Hurricane Sandy. And the garage and basement of a woman's home, Christine was her name, in Queens, New York, was flooded. And when this happened, everything was destroyed. Now, she counted her blessings, her husband, her five children, ages 2 to 12, and her adopted Shepherd Ridgeback mix, whose name was Buster. All of them were safe. This was great. Now, 6 months before Hurricane Sandy had hit, she had taken Buster home after finding this pathetic dog tied to a telephone pole. It had just been abandoned. Now, it was a month after this, after she had found this animal that had been abandoned, that when the house that they were living in, before it was destroyed, when they were working on it, this dog that they had adopted went through the front gate and ran off. She said, I was just absolutely destroyed. Nobody could find him. The construction workers felt very badly. However, on Facebook, don't you just love these stories? I do. She got a text from someone saying, look, you need to check out the Facebook page that lists animals scheduled to be euthanized at the New York City shelter. So she logs on, by golly, there's her dog, the dog she had rescued. He was apparently slated to be put to sleep 8 hours later at 6 a.m. Now, she couldn't call the shelter because at the time she found this on Facebook, it was closed for the night and wouldn't open to the public until 8 a.m. So she's in a dilemma. How's she going to get to her dog? Because the dog is going to be euthanized before the shelter even opens. So this is what she did. She drove to the shelter with all of her kids. She asked the woman at the front desk if her dog was still there, if Buster was still there. She said yes. And she had to prove her ownership. Well, how could she prove her ownership? This was a dilemma. She said, okay, you take me to the back of where he is, and you'll know immediately he's our dog. And by golly, she goes into the back of the shelter. Buster spied her and said, oh boy, he just went ballistic. The shelter worker said, I think this is your dog. And Buster went home. Now, the reason she shared this story is because she said it was just marvelous. And even though they had this tremendous tragedy occur with their own physical possessions, she said, what was important is the family. What is important is that all of us were safe and we're sound, and we are able to do what we need to do to rebuild our lives. We can do it. No matter what happens, together we can make it happen. We can rebuild whatever physically has been lost. But the love of your pet, your family, well, that is something that's extremely special. And I wanted to share her story with you because Buster, he's quite a guy. He's quite a lucky dog. Green eggs and ham. Oh, yes. Yes, I know. We all love that childhood story. Well, there is a wonderful aspect of that. There is a woman by the name of Lyndon who loves to cook. And she just said, why don't we feel better about greens in the diet? Now, you talk to anybody that's in nutrition, and they are going to say, put more greens in your diet, especially for women. Why? Because we need the minerals. And you'll find that most of your greens are going to be greens that come from the earth. That's right. Alfalfa, for example, and I didn't learn this until, I'd say about 5 to 7 years ago. I didn't realize alfalfa, one of the reasons it's so rich in nutrients, is because its roots go down 17 feet. That's right. You talk to someone that has an alfalfa farm, and they'll tell you those roots go down a long, long way. And there's many farms that don't use pesticides, so the alfalfa is extracting a lot of nutrients from the earth that it grows within. Greens are really, really important in the diet. And as we're coming into the winter months, it's very important to realize that those nutrients that are in those green vegetables can really benefit you in a very, very special way. Now, Lyndon had this recipe called greens and ricotta pie, and this is how simple it is. You to a pound of ricotta cheese, you can add 3 beaten eggs. You can use duck eggs. Have you ever used duck eggs? I've never used duck eggs, but there are people in the country that might be available to them. You stir in a cup of grated cheese. How about a Mexican blend or extra sharp cheddar? That's one of my favorites and my husband's. You need 2 tablespoons of white flour, 2 cups of a very finely chopped green. Put it into a pie shell that's been baked for 10 minutes first and bake for another 30 to 35 minutes. Now, what temperature, you're asking, Donna, should you bake this at? How about 375 degrees? Well, this is something that's very healthy. It's good hot or cold, and you could fix it in advance if you're going to have a busy weekend. It's something that's great to take to a potluck, but it is going to be very nutritious, and you could add different things to it if you like. But greens are very, very important nutritionally. That's why, for the Europeans, for so many generations, cabbage was a significant part of the diet because it withstood the cold winters and it was easy to preserve. Fermented sauerkraut was developed because of the nutritional values. They may not have understood completely the nutritional values as we do today, but that fermented food, sauerkraut, kept a lot of people healthy during the very, very cold winters. So keep that in mind. Remember, we live in a world today where we can have access to vegetables and to many things that were only available at some time seasonally. But I encourage you to support your local farmers markets because they really have the best produce of your particular area and environment, and that is going to work well for you to maintaining excellent health. This is Donna Sebo. Won't you join me tomorrow? Dr. Bernie Siegel is going to be my guest. And remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. God bless and have a magnificent day. Donna Sebo here. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.